We are starting a new series today. It is called Messy Church, Corinth, Different People, Same Mission. And really fitting about this message is that when this title is that when I first put it together, I misspelled different, which I think goes really well with Messy Church, right? We even have typos on our announcements. This morning we are going to talk about people. You are all people, I'm pretty sure. I am probably the only one in this room that has been accused of being a robot, but I can assure you that I too am a person, mostly like you. And because we are all people, we have certain tendencies. There are things that are kind of universal to people, no matter what their background is or you know where they came from. There are things that all of us do in our own way, shape, and form. Maybe you have heard of Montessori schools. Have you ever heard of those? Yeah, so Montessori schools are these schools that are centered on the learning, choosing the course that they want to take. Zeke went to one of these schools from kindergarten through third grade, and they do not operate like other schools do. In other schools, when they sit you down, they say, this is math, this is English, you do this. In Montessori schools, the kids have more freedom to choose what they want to do at what time. Which, you know, giving a bunch of kindergartners the right to choose what they want to do is sort of a risky prospect, but it does work in some cases. Now, here's what I didn't know. There was actually a Dr. Montessori, which makes sense because I don't know how I thought they got the name Montessori schools, but I didn't know there was a Dr. Montessori who came, and he came up with this model. And one of his main areas of interest in the way he came up with this was he was very interested in human tendencies. That there are things about us that we all need or that we all do or ways that we respond in different situations. So he identified the following tendencies in children specifically that needed to be recognized as they came up through school. So number one was movement, which is an excellent observation on his part. Curiosity, exploration, orientation, order, gregariousness, independence, communication, self-control, exactness, repetition, perfections, calculation, work, imitation, concentration, abstraction, and creative imagination. If you would like to recite that back to me, you're welcome to. But these are all the things, and he says, these are all the tendencies that children are born with, and they take place at different stages of development, and these tendencies need to be recognized if the children are going to grow and learn as you hope they will. But we know that although kids may have all these tendencies, children are not all the same. I have two children, and they are very much not the same. I was born a triplet with two sisters, and besides just the gender thing, we are all very different people. But it's interesting to think that as different as your kids may be, they still have all of these different things about them that they just find and discover in their own ways. Now, the same is true about us as adults. We all, as different as we are, we have similarities. We have tendencies that make us a part of who we all are. So let's focus on one such tendency. We all encounter stress, frustration, anger, sadness, and some of these things may be worse for some than others. And so, for example, I experience stress and sadness and anxiety more than I experience anger. Anger is not an emotion that I identify with much of the time. And when we experience these things and we are pushed to a limit where we don't know what to do anymore, we all have a way of coping. Now, well, we should all have a way of coping. Let me rephrase that. Although any reaction is a reaction to the stimulus that we face. So for example, when I get stressed or sad, one of the ways that I cope is I take a bath. And what that does for me is it slows down everything around me, and I sit in the hot water, and it helps things kind of, melt away a little bit, and more importantly, maybe than even those things, I am alone. And I'm alone with really nothing else to do besides read a book or flip through my phone. And therefore, I have time to just sort of calm down, let things wash away a little bit, and deal with what I am going through. So the point I want to make is that when we are pushed by something and we reach the point of being overwhelmed, we all do something, hopefully, that comforts us, that makes us feel better in some way. And for most of us, we go back to the same thing over and over again, because the familiarity of that thing is what is part of what makes it effective in our lives. The lure of the familiar to people is strong. You know, when we are feeling tense or out of place, what do we want? We want to be back in a place that is comfortable, that feels familiar, where we know kind of what's going on and what isn't. And it takes a world or situation that doesn't make sense and removes it from us, putting us in a place where we can think, avoid, brood, or cope. So the one thing I want you to sort of take away from this part of our talk today is that when we find ourselves not knowing what to do or pushed to a limit, we retreat to the familiar. Whether it's going home, whether it's reading a book or taking it, whatever it is, we go back to something that has shown itself to make sense to us in the past. You know, we don't add on to sort of the awkwardness or weirdness or strangeness that we feel in these kinds of situations by going to something that is more awkward and strange. That doesn't really help us deal with whatever it is that's in front of us. Although Kathy may do that, to be fair. She might go to the more strange. This morning, we are, again, starting a study on the church in Corinth. And the church in Corinth was an extremely messy church. They had a lot of different things going on that were not in line with the gospel that Paul had taught him, and Paul was not happy about it. So when Paul writes this letter to the church in Corinth, when he writes the letter of 1 Corinthians, he's already worked up about either things that he has heard or things that he knew were happening that just got worse after he left. And as we read about this messy church, it is really easy for us to be judgy about the church in Corinth. For example, when you have read the book of 1 Corinthians, what part are you in the story? Are you looking at it from God's point of view? Are you looking at it from Paul's point of view, trying to correct everyone? And I would guess that most of us, when we have read the book of 1 Corinthians, we have not put ourselves in the place of the Corinthians. And to be fair, there is good reason for that. Because the things that the Corinthians were doing were, by our accounts, bizarre. They don't make any sense at all. People were getting drunk at the Lord's Supper. I mean, amen? Richie, I appreciate your support, man, but people were getting drunk at the Lord's Supper. They were eating, the rich were eating all the food, and the poor didn't have anything to eat when they got there. Like, this place was dysfunctional, with a capital D-E-E. Now, which part do we play when we read it? And I know that when I have read the book of 1 Corinthians, one of the thoughts that always comes into my mind, and this is not a joke, is that, man, I'm glad we're not like these people. Because you're dealing from the viewpoint of Paul that he's already sort of instructed them and told them, and it's like, you know, it's like they just drove a bus off the cliff, as if nothing that Paul had told them sunk in. And here's the thing. The church in Corinth was made up of people. People who are just like us. They grew up in a certain place, they understood life in a certain way, and they had their own ways of dealing with difficult things. And just like any other group of people, they had things that comforted them and were familiar to them. So when they reached the point where they didn't know what to do or they didn't understand what was going on, what did they do? They went back to the familiar. They went back to what they knew. They had their own way of seeing and understanding the world. In order for us to better understand this whole dynamic and how it plays out, we are not going to start by examining Corinth. Instead, we are going to go back to the book of Exodus. Exodus! I tricked you, but not really. Why are we going back to the book of Exodus? Because there is one story that we have not talked about yet in the book of Exodus that shows us exactly how and why this happens. So if you have your Bibles, open up to Exodus chapter 32. Let me set the scene for you. The people of God crossed the Red Sea on dry land. Egypt was vanquished. The people were finally free to be the people of God. But it wasn't easy sailing once they had crossed the Red Sea. They started this long journey into the land of Canaan, and in order to get to Canaan, they had to cross vast miles of desert and wilderness. Now, the important thing for us to remember as we go into this story this morning is that they were just starting to understand what it meant to be the people of God. They were just beginning to know and appreciate what he was capable of. They saw how he controlled nature, creatures, and life through the plagues of Egypt. They saw how he delivered them from their enemy. But now, once they are on the other side of all of that, they had to learn what it was like to live with God every day. What does it mean now? To eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner as the people of God. What does it mean now to travel through difficult circumstances when you are the people of God? They were, for example, hungry. And they complained to Moses that they were hungry. And so God sent them quail and manna, meat and bread, for them to eat every day. And he gave them specific instructions about how much to gather, when to gather it, and how to use this bread in particular from heaven. And did they listen to God? No. Now, it's easy for us to sit back and say, why didn't they listen to God? But what are we not thinking about when we say, well, they should have just known to listen to God? Who were they in Egypt? Slaves. Which meant they had to work hard for every little single thing they had. And so therefore, when God feeds them, even though they're only supposed to take enough bread for what they need, they see the ground is full of bread. And so what do? Take as much as they can. They are still acting and functioning as a people who not long ago were slaves. And we shouldn't be surprised by that. How many times have we read parts of the Exodus story and asked ourselves, why are they doing this? And the answer we've always come to is, well, they're not listening to God, or they're not being faithful, or they don't trust him. And to a degree, those answers are true. But what we haven't always asked is, why? Is there a reason why they are acting like they do? They were thirsty and they needed water. Water's important, right? And there was no water anywhere because they were in the wilderness. And so they go and they complain to Moses, and God provided water from a rock. Now, to help us understand the rest of what happens in this story, we need to note that the Israelites didn't have the greatest attitude about all of this. They had definitely had a flair for the dramatic. And so instead of coming to Moses and saying, we don't have enough food, will God provide food for us? They would go up to Moses and say, Moses, we're in the desert and there is no food. Why did you bring us out into the desert to starve us to death? Why couldn't we just stay in Egypt and be slaves? So then Moses approaches God, and in my head, God rolls his eyes and then does the miraculous. In spite of everything they have seen and experienced, they still do not understand that God is the God of the miraculous in their lives. God has to show them over and over and over again, because while we may not want to admit it, and while certain, if the story went a different way, it would be cleaner for us, the fact of the matter is they have not figured out yet how to trust God. And so what does God do in response to that? He shows himself. You're hungry? Here's food. You're thirsty? Here's water. I am taking you to the land that will be yours. You just have to follow me. They ultimately arrived at the base of Mount Sinai, and Moses, their leader, the voice of God to them, went up the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments and the law. This was not a short process. The story about Moses being on the mountain starts in Exodus chapter 19, and it finishes at the end of Exodus chapter 31. During those chapters, he is constantly receiving instruction from God. Things that the people down at the bottom of the mountain do not know yet and have not heard. You with me? Okay. So let's pick it up here in part one. And what we want to ask first is, what is happening? What is the situation? What are we looking at? So let's look at verse one. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him." So Moses was gone for a long time. How long? We're not totally sure, but it was long enough to where the Israelites were like, "You know what? I'm done. I can't wait anymore. Where is he? He was supposed to be back at this point." And so their conclusion is, since he's not back now, he's probably not coming back. And so since he's not coming back, let's make gods that will go before us. The term there, they say to Aaron, "Make us gods," is an interesting one. When they say, "Make us gods," what are they asking for? They are asking for idols. They are asking for physical representation of their gods. Now, this seems to us like a terrible knee-jerk reaction to a situation that, in fact, is not out of control. Their one job was to wait at the base of the mountain and wait for Moses to come back down from his meeting with God. So the first thing we want to ask is, well, where did this come from? God had done all of these good things for them, and what is this? Like, they already want another God? It doesn't make sense, does it? Well, maybe we're not asking the right questions. The huge question that sits before us is not, if they want another God. The question is, why? Why are they asking for this specific thing? Why are they saying, "We can't wait for Moses. We need someone, another God, to come and lead us to the next step"? It's almost like they are saying, "Let's find someone, anyone, who can take us from this place where we have been waiting and nothing is happening." And it's worth noting, who do they go to? They go to Aaron. Moses is the leader. He's the one that knows everything about, what God is doing. God is speaking directly to him. And Aaron was the mouthpiece for Moses and therefore for God. So he is the one in the camp that has the most authority. So it is a bit telling that they go to him, the one who has helped lead them, help them follow God, and say, "We need to figure something else out." Which takes us to part two. This is really not the way to do it. Let's look at verses 2-6. Aaron answered them, Take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me. So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they had handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to who? The Lord." So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterwards, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Okay, we have been blinded by the calf. We have, because that's what catches our eye, that there is a golden calf. You read through your Bible, the heading of this section is the golden calf. But hopefully when you read through this again, what state of mind are the people in? If I had to put it into one term, I would call it extreme confusion. Well, thank you. If I were to put it into two words, it would be severely extreme confusion. They are grasping for something. And why are they grasping for something? Because they don't know what to do. They think Moses is dead, the representative of God. They think he's gone. Therefore, in their minds, there is no one to communicate to God with them. So what they need is some way to do that. So let's try to unpack what was going on. Aaron was left in charge while Moses was up on the mountain. The people came to him and they told him they wanted idols to follow. And what did Aaron do? This is one of the most shocking parts to me of the story. Aaron's like, okay, go get your gold. And he becomes the leader of this effort to make a golden calf. Does that seem normal if we are reading it from a this is right, this is wrong kind of perspective? No, he knows more about God than anyone except Moses. He has been behind the scenes making this stuff happen, and he's the one that when the people come to him say, yes, let's make an idol. Now, who did he make the idol to? This is the interesting question. Because the people say, here are your gods. Who did what? Led you out of Egypt. Huh? Who led them out of Egypt? God did. Did they know that God led them out of Egypt? So, what are they even asking for then? The request and their response to it continues to not make sense. They already know who brought them out, and yet they're talking about these gods who they say led them out of Egypt. Why is all this happening? And the answer is really unsatisfying, but I'm going to give it to you anyway because that is my job. They were scared and confused. They did not know what to do or how to proceed without Moses, who was the voice of God, to tell them. We also have to remember they had, as a people, no formal ways to worship God. The most formal way that the Israelite people would worship God was by going to holy places where God had appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and they would worship God in those places. They had a sense of making offerings to God over different things. We're told in the Exodus story that they fall down in worship when Moses returns to them and tells them what God's plan is. But when we hear the word worship, and we hear the words people of God, we think of church. We think of a place where you come and sing and you pray. We might even, in this case, think of the temple and think of all the instructions that God had for them to worship. And the thing that we fail to appreciate is that they didn't know any of that. They didn't know any of that. And so what did they do? They fell back on what they knew. And where did their main education about gods and worshiping gods come from? It came from Egypt. And what would you do in Egypt? You would make a physical object that represented whatever god it was you wanted to worship, because remember, there were a lot, and you would worship that object. The thinking being that this object is a representation of the god you are worshiping. And by offering sacrifices to this representation, you are inviting the god down into your presence to do whatever that god does. Where was Moses? And who was he? Moses was not an idol, right? But he was the physical form that people could look at and relate to and say, there's God. This guy knows who's God. And when that guy is gone, they fall back on what they knew. They had been in Egypt for generations. And they had seen people worship idols over and over and over again. So their response to this confusion was, well, let's build an idol and worship it. And why did they build a golden calf? We don't know. Other than that, that was a representation of different gods in Egypt. So maybe it was like casting a bigger net. If we do this more common object, then maybe that will bring God closer to us. But the thing we have to appreciate is that they were in completely unknown territory. They are wandering in the desert. They are living in tents. They are eating food that is falling from heaven and drinking water from rocks. There is nothing normal about their lives. And when the anchor that held them in place was gone, they simply went back to what they knew. So they say, this confusing statement, these are our gods who led us out of Egypt. But Aaron says that this golden calf represents who? The Lord. And that the next day, they are going to have a festival for whom? The Lord. And everybody comes out the next day and offer sacrifices before the golden calf to whom? The Lord. It's weird. It's weird. It's much more complex than simply saying they didn't trust God or they thought they would build an idol and worship the idol instead of God. What becomes clear is they were so lost and confused. They knew who had brought them out, but they didn't know how to refer to him anymore. And even Aaron, who had been there with Moses all along, jumps in with this idea and says, you're right, this is the Lord. Let's worship him. Let's celebrate him. So something we must know. Again, and I'm sorry to be repetitive, but if you read through chapters 39 through 31, Moses is given a lot of instruction about worship. And I think sometimes, even though I knew it wasn't true, the assumption is that because Moses is getting all this information, well, somehow the people magically knew this, instead of understanding that they're in a point without any answers. That there's nothing for them, even Aaron, to fall back on in terms of God. And they're not letting go of him entirely. He is still the God who brought them out of Egypt. He is still the God who is providing for them. And as much as we might say that they should have known better, the fact is that they didn't. They didn't know better. It was the wrong choice. But when you read through it, and you read through it again, and we ask ourselves this question, it becomes kind of clear that they don't seem to know it's the wrong choice. You with me? They don't seem to know it's the wrong choice. Does that make it right? No, it's still the wrong choice. But maybe it helps us ask a different question. Are they faithless? Or do they not know what to do? Does it have to be one of those things or the other? No, we could fill in a bunch of things in there. But that's one of the main questions that I think sits in front of us. Are they intentionally being faithless to God? Or are they people who, when they run up against something where they don't know where to go and don't know what to do, they fall back on what they know? It's not the right thing to do, but it's what happens. And to add insult to injury to all of this, they worship, they throw all these things, they sacrifice to the golden calf that is supposed to be God, and then they have this huge party, all this revelry. Meanwhile, Moses is still on the mountain talking to God. So I call this next part of our sermon this morning, Dad is on his way home. From verses 7 through 10 of Exodus 32. Then the Lord said to Moses, go down because your people, who you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. Funny thing here. Whose people are they? They're Moses' people. They are no longer God's people. These are Moses' people. They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. I have seen these people, the Lord said to Moses, and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone, so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation. There's a story that we don't talk about a whole lot in my family, and therefore the details to me are a little bit fuzzy. My brother and sister are much older than I am. My brother was a senior in high school when I was born. My sister was a sophomore. I think she was a sophomore, might have been a freshman. And they were the only two kids that my parents had. And growing up, they had two cars. They had a 1966 Mustang, and they had a 1966 Jeep CJ5. And my mom drove the Mustang until my brother started driving it when he got his driver's license, and my dad drove the Jeep to and from work. This was how it went. So my parents went on a trip, and my brother decided that he wanted to clean the Jeep for my dad. Now, if I say to you, I'm going to clean your car, what does that mean? Wash it, vacuum it, wipe things down. My brother decided to take the entire engine apart, spread it out over the grass to clean every part of the engine. I don't know exactly how old he was at this point either. Like I said, details are a little fuzzy. My parents came home early, and there was the Jeep in pieces on the front lawn. That is as much as I know. I don't know what happened next. I can speculate about what happened next. God is up on the mountain. He is giving Moses directions, instructions about how these people can be the people of God. And he looks down, and they are doing things that they should not be doing. And God is angry. Very, very angry. He is so angry that he decides he wants to start over. It has not been smooth sailing again. So let's consider how all of this looks from God's perspective. God had been providing for them, right? And what was their attitude? Almost as if, one, God wasn't taking into consideration what their needs were. And two, this ongoing thing about God leading them to these places to die. If you remember from our last story in Egypt, why did you bring us out here? Are there not enough graves in Egypt that you had to bring us out here so there's more room to bury people? They are dramatic. And how does God respond? He provides. But this stuff has to be building up a little bit, right? Because has God been through this with his people before? Not in this exact way, but yes. He has seen them not appreciate what he has done. He has seen them not realize what he is giving to them and how he is blessing them, leading them. He has seen them try to complain and make their own way. It became apparent that they didn't really trust God to provide for their needs, and God was smart enough to know this. So consequently, by the time this episode with the calf goes down, God was already frustrated, to say, you know, sort of a middle-of-the-road emotion there. So then he sees the golden calf, and he hears this statement, "Come worship the calf. These are the gods who led you out of Egypt." And what does God hear from that? This is one of the rare moments where we have someone interacting with God, and we get a look at what God is thinking when he sees this happen. Number one, it's clear they don't understand who he is. Number two, he has shown them that he is not like other gods. He is infinitely greater and more powerful, and yet they try to represent him with a stinking cow. At least they didn't make a chicken, right? At least it's a cow. But think about how insulting that is to the God of the universe to be represented by a farm animal. There is nothing good in God's mind or even understandable about this because it is incredibly insulting. How is it God is asking that they don't know me more than this? How is it that they don't understand more than this? This is awful. This is awful. How are they not getting it? And you can almost hear God asking the question between the verses, is this what this is going to be like? Is this, they are a stiff-necked people, meaning what? If your neck is stiff, what do you do with it? You keep it straight. You don't look to the right, to the left, up, or down. You are simply focused on what literally is directly in front of you. They are a stiff-necked people who complained about not having food as if God were going to let them die, complained about not having water as if God were going to let them die. And now Moses is gone for a few days and they have constructed a golden calf. Is this how it's going to be? You know what? Moses, they're your people, but I'm going to start over with you. The answer, is this who they are, is what? Yeah, this is who they are. Why is this who they are? Because they're people. They're people. And when they get scared, when they get confused, they do whatever they can to drag themselves back to the familiar and take control in terms that they could understand. Which leads us to part four. Help them understand. Verses 11 through 16. But Moses sought the favor of the Lord, his God. Lord, he said, why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say it was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth? That was a really tricky thing that Moses brought up to God there. We'll talk about that in a second. Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever. Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened. Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant of law in his hands. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God engraved on their tablets. Okay, so Moses is so bold as to lay out a counter-argument before God. I don't recommend you do this in general. So we have to say that, you know, Moses and God had a pretty special relationship at that point. So he effectively reasons with God. And here's what he says. If you kill them now, Egypt will say that you brought them out into the desert for evil purposes, to kill them. Which, by the way, is what the Israelite people have been saying every time something goes wrong. So Moses challenges him with this, are you going to be who everyone thinks you are, which God is already frustrated with, or are you going to be something other than that? Because it's not a good look if you free your people from Egypt and kill them at the base of this mountain. He then reminded God of who he is. You made a promise to Abraham and his descendants. If you kill them, you will break that promise. This is reminiscent. This is reminiscent of Abraham pleading with God outside the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's not like God has forgotten who he is. He is God, right? But we see in these kind of rare occasions where someone who God trusts speaks back to God. And God comes around to be who he is. Not that he was ever going to be something else. But his anger subsides. Would God have been wrong to kill the Israelites? The answer is no. And there's lots of reasons why the answer is no. Number one, God doesn't do the wrong things. It's part of why he's God, right? So that's a fundamental theological idea. But secondly, Moses is a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so by starting over with Moses, is he breaking the promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? No, it's just going to take longer for the descendants to build back up again and for them to have their own land. God had not forgotten all these things. Moses did not have to show him the right way, but it is important to see that God is frustrated with his people. And it is also important to see that God chooses to be patient, to take time, to put all of his effort and forgiveness into making this work, even though he knows stuff like this is going to keep happening. God makes that decision. And so one of the most remarkable things throughout this entire story is that God chooses to keep a people who had betrayed him. That's remarkable, isn't it? Now, what does this have to do with Corinth? The struggles that the Israelite people had in the desert are the same struggles that the Corinthians had. They were trying to live a new life with a God they were just getting to know, without really understanding what it looked like to live a life formed by Jesus in contrast to the lives that they were used to living. My speculation is they did some things really well. Pure speculation on my part. But we know all the things they didn't get. And the question that we have to ask as we go through is, why did they make the choices they made? Are they simply rebellious against God, or is there potentially another reason? Does the other reason make it right? No. But it helps us understand what they were going through, and the reason why. We need to understand why the Israelites went back to what they knew and the Corinthians went back to what they knew is that we do the same thing. We are not so different. I mean, maybe we're not getting drunk at communion, right? But what happens to us in our faith where we come up against something that we don't know how to handle, that we can't move, and we don't know what our next step is? And you know how complicated that process is from that point, right? Because we struggle in those moments to trust God with the things that we don't know and understand. And it is a constant fight, isn't it? And in our worst moments, we fall back on the things that make us comfortable instead of dealing with what is right in front of us with the power of God. Both in Israel and Corinth, we see that following God, being a community that follows Jesus, required them to live in a way that was very different from the life they knew. And this new life felt strange and uncomfortable. And they didn't understand how it worked. They tried and they failed and they tried and they failed. But the thing we see coming out of both of these things is that if they are going to make it as the people of God, they have to learn to live a different life. When are they going to stop learning about that different life? Never. Because we know the secret over here that we are still learning about what it means to live a life that reflects Jesus Christ. They didn't know how to do that, but in the end, they were the people of a God who was loving and full of grace, a God who was annoyed, but patient, a God who was frustrated, but loved. Because you see, these stories are not just stories about how people failed, which is how we look at them a lot of the time. These are not just stories about how people failed. Ultimately, they are stories of a God who stuck with people who failed over and over and over and over again. And that, my friends, is good news. Because I don't know about you, but when I'm honest with myself, I know that my life with God, if I were to grade it, is represented more by the things I don't do right or very well than it is by the things that I do that I feel like glorifies God. I look in the mirror, I can see that clearly. But the thing is, God removes the mirror and stands in front of us and says, yeah, you are all of those things, but with me, you are more. And we get to see ourselves through the eyes of a God who gave up his own son so that our failures won't be held against us. Hallelujah. Praise God. So if we cling to anything through these stories, it should be that we are a lot more like these groups of people than we may like to admit. And not just in a wink-wink sort of way, but in real practical ways, we are like these people. And we can celebrate in the fact that their story doesn't end with just the things they do wrong. Even making a golden calf to the God, to represent the God of the universe. God doesn't give them to Moses. They are still his people. And he leads them through more difficulty than we can imagine. But he doesn't give up on them. That is the gospel that we live under today. And in this one story of a bunch of people who are confused and afraid and don't get it, we see God just begin to show the world who he really is. Not a God who puts up with a lot of stuff, but a God who loves through all the things. Amen?